This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Inkspell by Cornelia Funke. Read for you by Brendan Fraser. Chapter 1. Words Made to Measure. Twilight was gathering, and Orpheus still wasn't here. Farid's heart beat faster, as it always did when Day left him alone in the darkness.
Curse that cheese face, where could he be?
The birds were falling silent in the trees, as if the approach of night had stifled their voices, and the nearby mountains were turning black. You might have thought the setting sun had singed them. Soon, the whole world would be black as pitch. Even the grass beneath Farid's bare feet, and the ghosts would begin to whisper. Farid knew only one place where he felt safe from them, right behind Dustfinger, so close that he could feel his warmth. Dustfinger wasn't afraid of the night. He liked it.
Hearing them again, are you?
He asked as Farid pressed close to him. How many times do I have to tell you? There aren't any ghosts in this world. One of its few advantages. Dustfinger stood there, leaning against an oak tree, looking down the lonely road. In the distance, a street lamp cast its light on the cracked asphalt where a few houses huddled by the roadside. There were scarcely a dozen of them standing close together as if they feared the night as much as Farid. The house where Cheeseface lived was the first on the road. There was a light on behind one of its windows. Dustfinger had been staring at it for more than an hour. Farid had often tried standing motionless like that, but his limbs simply would not keep still.
I'm going to find out where he is.
No, you're not. Dustfinger's face was as expressionless as ever, but his voice gave him away. Farid heard the impatience in it, and the hope that refused to die, although it had been disappointed so often before.
Are you sure he said Friday?
Yeah, and this is Friday night, right? Dustfinger just nodded, and pushed his shoulder-length hair back from his face. Farid had tried growing his own hair long, but it was so curly, tangled, and unruly that in the end he just cut it short again with his knife.
Friday outside the village at 4 o'clock, that's what he said, while that dog of his growled at me as if he really craved a nice crunchy boy to eat.
The wind blew through Farid's thin sweater, and he rubbed his arms, shivering. A good warm fire. That's what he'd have liked now, but Dustfinger wouldn't let him light so much as a match in this wind.
4 o'clock,
cursing quietly, Farid looked up at the darkening sky. He knew it was well past four, even without a watch.
I tell you, he's making his way on purpose, the stuck-up idiot.
Dustfinger's thin lips twisted into a smile. Farid was finding it easier and easier to make him smile.
Perhaps that's why he'd promised to take Farid, too. Supposing Orpheus really did send Dustfinger back. Back to his own world, created from paper, printer's ink, and an old man's words.
Oh, come on, thought Farid.
How would Orpheus, of all people, succeed where all the others had failed? So many had tried it. The Stammerer, Golden Eyes, Raven Tongue, swindlers who had taken their money.
The light went out behind Orpheus' window, and Dustfinger abruptly straightened up. A door closed. The sound of footsteps echoed through the darkness. Rapid, irregular footsteps. Then, Orpheus appeared in the light of the single street lamp. Farid had privately nicknamed him Cheeseface because of his pale skin and the way he sweated like a piece of cheese in the sun. Breathing heavily, he walked down the slope of the road with his hellhound beside him. It was ugly as a hyena. When Orpheus saw Dustfinger standing by the roadside, he stopped, smiled broadly, and waved to him. Farid grasped Dustfinger's arm.
Look at that silly grin, false as fool's gold, he whispered. How can you trust him?
Who says I trust him? What's the matter with you, your old jittery? Would you rather stay here? Cars? Moving pictures? Canned music? Light that keeps the night away?
Dustfinger clambered over the knee-high wall beside the road.
You like all that? You'll be bored to death where I want to go. What was he talking about? As if he didn't know perfectly well that there was only one thing Farid wanted. To stay with him. He was about to reply angrily, but a sharp crack, like boots treading on a twig, made him spin around. Dustfinger heard it, too. He had stopped and was listening.
There was nothing to be seen among the trees, only the branches moving in the wind and a moth, pale as a ghost, that fluttered in Farid's face.
Whew! I'm sorry. It took longer than I expected, cried Orpheus as he approached them.
Farid still couldn't grasp the fact that such a voice could emerge from that mouth. They had heard about Orpheus's voice in several villages, and Dustfinger had set out at once in search of it, but not until a week ago had they found the man himself in a library, reading fairy tales to a few children. None of the children seemed to notice the dwarf who suddenly slipped out from behind one of the shelves crammed with well-thumbed books. But Dustfinger had seen him.
He had lain in wait for Orpheus, approaching him just as he was about to get into his car again, and finally he'd shown him the book. The book that Farid had cursed more often than anything else on Earth.
Oh, I know that book, Orpheus had breathed. And as for you, he had added almost devoutly, looking at Dustfinger as if to stare the scars from his cheeks. I know you too. You're the best thing in it. Dustfinger, the Fire Eater. Who read you here into this saddest of all stories?
No, don't say anything. You want to go back, don't you?
But you can't find the door. The door hidden among the letters on the page. Never mind. I can build you a new one. With words made to measure. For a special price.
Between friends.
If you're really the man I take you for.
A special price. Between friends. What a laugh. They'd had to promise him almost all their money, and then wait for him hours in this godforsaken spot on this windy night that smelled of ghosts.
Is the Martin in there?
Orpheus shone his flashlight on Dustfinger's backpack.
You know my dog doesn't like him.
No, he's finding something to eat.
Dustfinger's eyes wandered to the book under Orpheus's arm. Well, have you done it?
Of course.
As Orpheus spoke, the hellhound bared his teeth and glared at Farid.
To start with, the words were rather hard to find. Perhaps because I was so excited, as I told you at our first meeting. This book, Inkheart,
Orpheus stroked the volume, was my favorite when I was a child.
I was 11 when I last saw it. I kept borrowing it from our rundown library until it was stolen. Unfortunately, I hadn't been brave enough to steal it myself, and then somebody else did, but I never forgot it. This book taught me once and for all how easily you can escape this world with the help of words. You can find friends between the pages of a book. Wonderful friends. Friends like you. Fire eaters. Giants.
Fairies.
Oh, have you any idea how bitterly I wept when I read about your death? But you're alive, and everything will be all right.
You will retell the story, eh? Dustfinger interrupted him with an amused look.
No, believe me, that's a task for others. Well, perhaps.
Orpheus cleared his throat as if he felt embarrassed to have revealed so much of his feelings.
However that may be, it's a shame I can't go with you, he said, making for the wall beside the road with his curiously awkward gait. But the reader has to stay behind. That's the iron rule. I tried every way I could to read myself into a book, but it just won't work. Sighing, he stopped by the wall, put his hand under his ill-fitting jacket, and brought out a sheet of paper.
Well, this is what you asked for, he told Dustfinger. Wonderful words, just for you.
A road of words to take you straight back again. Here, read it. Hesitantly, Dustfinger took the sheet of paper. It was covered with fine, slanting handwriting, the letters tangled like thread. Dustfinger slowly ran his finger along the words, as if he had to show each of them separately to his eyes. Orpheus watched him like a schoolboy waiting to be told the mark his work had earned. When Dustfinger finally looked up again, he sounded surprised.
You write very well. Those are beautiful words.
Orpheus turned as red as if someone had spilled mulberry juice over his face. I'm glad you like it.
I like it very much. It's all just as I described it to you. Even sounds a little better.
Orpheus took the sheet of paper back with an awkward smile.
I can't promise you that it'll be the same time of day there, he said in a muted voice. The laws of my yard's difficult to understand, but believe me, no one knows more about them than I do. For instance, I discovered that if you want to change or continue a story, you should only use words that are already in the book. Too many new words and nothing at all may happen, or alternatively, something could happen that you didn't intend. Perhaps it's different if you wrote the original story.
In the name of all the fairies, you're full of words in the whole library,
Dustfinger interrupted impatiently.
How about just reading it now?
Orpheus fell silent as abruptly as if he had just swallowed his tongue.
Hey, well, by all means, he said in slightly injured tones. Well, now you see, with my help, the book will welcome you back like a prodigal son. It will suck you up the way paper absorbs ink.
Yeah, Dustfinger just nodded and looked down the empty road. Farid sensed how much he wanted to believe Cheeseface, and how afraid he was of another disappointment.
What about me? Farid went up to him. He did write something about me too, didn't he? Did you check it?
Orpheus gave him a rather nasty look.
My God, he said sarcastically to Dustfinger, that boy really does seem fond of you. Where'd you pick him up, somewhere along the road?
Not exactly, said Dustfinger. He was plucked out of his story by the man who did me the same favor.
Ah, yes, that, Silvertongue.
Orpheus spoke the name in a disparaging tone, as if he couldn't believe that anyone really deserved it.
Yes, that's what he's called.
How do you know?
There was no mistaking Dustfinger's surprise. The hellhound snuffled at Farid's bare toes. Orpheus shrugged.
Sooner or later you get to hear everyone who can breathe life into the letters on a page.
Indeed.
Dustfinger sounded skeptical, but he asked no more questions. He just stared at the sheet of paper covered with Orpheus's fine handwriting. But Cheeseface was still looking at Farid.
What book do you come from, he asked, and why don't you want to go back into your own story instead of his, which has nothing to do with you?
That's none of your business, replied Farid angrily.
He liked Cheeseface less and less. He was too inquisitive and far too shrewd. But Dustfinger just laughed quietly.
His own story? No. Farid isn't in the least homesick for that one.
The boy switches from story to story like a snake changing its skin.
Farid heard something like admiration in his voice.
Does he indeed?
Orpheus looked at Farid again so patronizingly that the boy would have liked to kick his fat shins. But the hellhound was still glaring hungrily at him.
Very well, said Orpheus, sitting down on the wall. I'm warning you all the same. Reading you back is easy, but the boy has no business in your story. I can't put his name into it. I can only say a boy. And as you know, I can't guarantee that it will work.
Even if it does, he'll probably just cause confusion. He may even bring you bad luck.
Whatever did the wretched man mean?
Farid looked at Dustfinger.
Please, he thought. Oh, please, don't listen to him. Take me with you.
Dustfinger returned his gaze and smiled. Bad luck, he said, and his voice conveyed the certainty that no one could tell him anything he didn't already know about bad luck.
Pfft, nonsense. So far the boy has brought me nothing but good luck instead. And he's not a bad fire eater. He's coming with me.
And so is this.
Before Orpheus realized what he meant, Dustfinger picked up the book that Cheeseface had put down on the wall beside him. You won't be needing it anymore, and I shall sleep considerably more easily if it's in my possession.
Dismayed, Orpheus stared at him.
But I told you it's my favorite book. I really would like to keep it.
And so would I,
was all Dustfinger said as he handed the book to Farid. Here, take good care of it. Farid clutched it to his chest and nodded. Now for Gwyn, he said. We must call him. But just as he took a little dry bread from his trouser pocket and was about to call Gwyn's name, Dustfinger put a hand over Farid's mouth. Gwyn stays here, he said. If he had announced that he was planning to leave his right arm behind, Farid couldn't have looked at him more incredulously. Why are you staring at me like that? We'll catch ourselves another mountain once we're there, one that's not so ready to bite.
Well, at least you've seen sense there, said Orpheus, his voice sounding injured.
Oh, whatever was he talking about? But Dustfinger avoided the boy's questioning gaze.
Come on, start reading, he told Orpheus. I will still be standing here at sunrise.
Orpheus looked at him for a moment as if he were about to say something else, but then he cleared his throat.
Yes, he said. Yes, you're right. 10 years in the wrong story. That's a long time. Let's start reading.
Words. Words filled the night like the fragrance of invisible flowers. Words made to measure, written by Orpheus with his dough-pale hands, words taken from the book that Farid was clutching tightly and then fitted together into a new meaning. They spoke of another world, a world full of marvels and terrors, and Farid, listening, forgot time. He didn't even feel that there was such a thing. Nothing existed but the voice of Orpheus, so ill-suited to the mouth it came from. It obliterated everything. The potholed road in the run-down houses at the far end of it, the street lamp, the wall where Orpheus was sitting, even the moon above the black trees. And suddenly the air smelled strange and sweet.
He can do it, thought Farid. He really can do it.
And meanwhile, the voice of Orpheus made him blind and deaf to everything that wasn't made of the written letters on the sheet of paper. When Chi's face suddenly fell silent, Farid looked around him in confusion, dizzy from the beautiful sound of the words. But why were the houses still there, and the street lamp all rusty from wind and rain? Orpheus was still there, too, and his hellhound. Only one thing was missing. Dustfinger. But Farid was still standing on the same lonely road, in the wrong world. Chapter 2 Fool's Gold.
No!
Farid heard the horror in his own voice.
No! What have you done? Where has he gone?
Orpheus rose ponderously from the wall, still holding that wretched piece of paper, and he smiled.
Home. Where else? But what about me? Go on reading, go on!
Everything was blurred by the tears in his eyes. He was alone again, alone as he had always been before he found Dustfinger. Farid began trembling so hard that he didn't even notice Orpheus taking the book from his hands.
And here's the proof of it once again, he heard the man murmur. I bear my name by right. I am the master of all words, both written and spoken. No one can compete with me.
Master of words! What are you talking about?
Farid shouted in such a loud voice that even the hellhound flinched.
If you know so much about your trade, then why am I still here? Go on, start reading again, and give me that book back!
He reached for it, but Orpheus avoided him with surprising agility.
The book? Why should I give it to you? You probably can't even read. Let me tell you something. If I'd wanted you to go with him, then you'd be there now. But you have no business in his story, so I just left out what I'd written about you. Understand? Now, be off before I set my dog on you. Boys like you threw stones at him when he was a puppy, and he's enjoyed chasing your sword ever since.
You brute! You liar! You traitor!
Farid's voice broke.
Hadn't he known it? Hadn't he told Dustfinger? Cheeseface was as false as fool's gold!
Something made its way between his bare feet, something furry and round-nosed with tiny horns between its ears. The marten.
He's gone, Gwyn, thought Farid. Dustfinger's gone. We'll never see him again.
The hellhound lowered its bulky head and took a hesitant step toward the marten. But Gwyn bared his needle-sharp teeth, and the huge dog withdrew its nose in astonishment. Its fear gave Farid fresh courage.
Give it to me!
He rammed his thin fist into Orpheus's chest.
That piece of paper and the book, too, or I'll slit you up like a carp! I swear I will!
but he couldn't help sobbing, which made the words sound nowhere near as impressive as he had intended. Orpheus patted his dog's head as he stowed away the book in the waistband of his trousers.
Dear me, that really scares us, Cerberus, doesn't it?
Gwyn pressed close to Farid's ankles, his tail twitching uneasily back and forth. Even when the marten ran across the road and disappeared into the trees on the other side, Farid thought it was because of the dog. Deaf and blind, he kept thinking later. You were deaf and blind, Farid. But Orpheus smiled, like someone who knows more than his opponent.
Let me tell you, my young friend, he said. It gave me a terrible fright when Dustfinger wanted the book back. Luckily, he handed it to you. Well, I couldn't have done anything for him. It was hard enough persuading my clients not to just kill him. But I made them promise. Only on that condition would I act as bait. Bait. For the book. Because in case you haven't caught on yet, this is all about the book. The book and nothing else. They promised not to hurt a hair on Dustfinger's head, but I'm afraid no one said a word about you.
And before Farid realized what Cheeseface was talking about, he felt a knife at his throat. Sharp as the edge of a reed, colder than mist among the trees.
Well, well, who have we here?
A well-remembered voice murmured in his ear.
Didn't I last see you with Silvertongue? Seems you helped Dustfinger steal the book for him, isn't that so? What a fine little fellow you are.
The knife scratched Farid's skin, and the man breathed peppermint into his face. If he hadn't known Basta by his voice, then that stinking breath would have identified the man. His knife and a few mint leaves. Basta was never without them. He chewed the leaves and then he spat out what remained. He was dangerous as a rabid dog and not too bright, but how did he come to be here? How had he found them?
Well, how do you like my new knife? Basta purred into Farid's ear. I'd have liked to introduce the Fire Eater to it too, but Orpheus here, he has a weakness for him. Never mind. I'll find Dustfinger again. Him, and Silvertongue, and Silvertongue's witch of a daughter. They'll all pay.
Pay for what? Said Farid, saving you from the shadow. But Basta only pressed the blade more firmly against his neck.
Saving me? They brought me bad luck. Nothing but bad luck.
Oh, for heaven's sake, put that knife away, Orpheus interrupted, sounding sickened. It's only a boy.
Let him go. I have the book as we agreed, so... Let him go.
Basta laughed aloud, but the laughter died in his throat. A snarling sound came from the woods behind them, and the hellhound laid back its ears. Basta spun around.
Oh, what the devil, you... Ow, you damned idiot! What have you let out of the book?
Freed did not want to know the answer. He felt Basta loosen his grip for a moment. That was enough. He bit the man's hand so hard that he tasted blood. Basta screamed and dropped the knife. Farid jerked back his elbows, rammed them into the man's narrow chest, and ran. But he had entirely forgotten the little wall by the roadside. He stumbled on it. He fell to his knees so hard that he was left gasping for breath. As he picked himself up, he saw the paper lying on the asphalt, the sheet of paper that had carried Dustfinger away. The wind must have blown it into the road. With quick fingers, he reached for it.
I just left out what I'd written about you. Understand?
Orpheus's words still rang in his head, mocking him. Farid clutched the sheet of paper to his chest and ran on, over the road and toward the dark trees waiting on the other side. The hellhound was growling and barking behind him. Then it howled. Something snarled again so fiercely that Farid ran even faster. Orpheus screamed, fear making his voice shrill and ugly. Basta swore, and then the snarl came again, wild as the snarling of the great cats that had lived in Farid's old world.
Don't look around, he thought. Run, run, he told his legs. Let the cat eat the hellhound. Let it eat them all, Basta and Cheeseface included. Just keep running.
The dead leaves lying under the trees were damp and muffled the sound of his footsteps, but they were slippery, too, and made him lose his balance on the steep slope. Desperately, he caught hold of a tree trunk, pressed himself against it, knees trembling, and listened to the sounds of the night. Could Basta hear him gasping?
A sob escaped his throat. He pressed his hands to his mouth. The book. Basta had the book. He'd been supposed to look after it. How was he ever going to find Duskfinger again now? Farid felt the sheet of paper that held Orpheus's words. He was still holding it tight. It was damp and dirty. And now it was his only hope.
Oi! You little bastard! Bite me, would you?
Basta's voice reached him through the quiet night air.
You can run, but I'll get you yet! Do you hear? You, the fire eater, Silver Tongue and his hoity-toity daughter, and the old man who wrote those accursed words! I'll kill you all! One by one! The way I've just slit open a beast that came out of the book!
Farid hardly dared to breathe. Go on, he told himself. Go on, he can't see you. Trembling, he felt for the next tree trunk, sought a handhold, and was grateful to the wind for blowing through the leaves and drowning out his footsteps with their rustling. How many times do I have to tell you that there aren't any ghosts in this world? One of its few advantages. He heard Dustfinger's voice as clearly as if he were still following the Fire Eater. Farid kept repeating the words as tears ran down his face and thorns gashed his feet. There are no ghosts. There are no ghosts. There are no ghosts. A branch whipped against his face so hard that he almost cried out. Were they following him? He couldn't hear anything except the wind. He slipped again and stumbled down the slope. Nettles stung his legs, burrs caught in his hair, and something jumped up at him, furry and warm, pushing its nose into his face. Gwyn? Farid felt the little head. Yes, there were the tiny horns. He pressed his face into the marten's soft fur. Basta's back, Gwyn, he whispered, and he has the book. Suppose Orpheus reads him over again. He's sure to go back into the book sometime, don't you think? How are we going to warn Dustfinger about him now? Farid twice found himself back at the road that wound down the mountain, but he dared not walk along it and instead made his way on through the prickly undergrowth. Soon every breath he drew hurt, but he did not stop. Only when the first rays of the sun made their way through the trees, and Basta still hadn't appeared behind him, did he know that he had gotten away. Now what? He thought as he lay in the damp grass, gasping for breath. Now what? And suddenly he remembered another voice. The voice that had brought him into this world. Silvertongue. Of course. Only Silvertongue could help Farid now, he or his daughter Maggie. They were living with the bookworm woman these days. Farid had once been there with Dustfinger. It was a long way to go, particularly with the cuts on his feet. But he had to get there before Basta did. Chapter 3. Dustfinger Comes Home. For a moment, Dustfinger felt as if he had never been away. As if he'd simply had a bad dream, and the memory of it left a stale taste on his tongue. A shadow on his heart. Nothing more. All of a sudden, everything was back again. The sounds, so familiar and never forgotten. The scents. The tree trunks dappled in the morning light. The shadow of the leaves on his face. Some were turning color, like the leaves in that other world. So autumn must be coming here, too. But the air was still mild. It smelled of overripe berries. Fading blossoms, a thousand or more flowers dazing his senses, flowers pale as wax glimmering under the shade of the trees, blue stars on stems so thin and delicate that he walked carefully so as not to tread on them, oaks, planes, tulip trees towering to the sky all around him. He had almost forgotten how huge a tree could be, how broad and tall its trunk, with a leaf canopy spreading so wide that a whole troop of horsemen could shelter beneath it. The forests of the other world were still so young, their trees still children. They always made him feel old, so old that the years covered him like cobwebs. Here he was young again, just a child among the trees, not much older than the mushrooms growing among their roots, not much taller than the thistles and nettles. But where was the boy? Dustfinger looked around, searching for him, calling his name again and again.
Farid!
It was a name that had almost become as familiar to him as his own over the last few months. But there was no reply. only his own voice echoing back from the trees. So that was it. The boy had been left behind. What would he do now, all alone?
Well, thought Dustfinger as he looked around in vain one last time.
What do you think? Well, he'll manage better in that world than you ever did. The noise, the speed, the crowds of people, he likes all that. And you've taught him enough of your craft. He can play with fire almost as well as you can. Yes, the boy will manage very well.
But for a moment, the joy of his homecoming wilted in Dustfinger's heart like one of the flowers at his feet, and the morning light that had welcomed him only a moment ago now seemed wan and lifeless. The other world had cheated him again. Yes, it had let him go after all those years, but it had kept the only beings there to whom he had given his heart.
Well, what does that teach you? He thought, kneeling in the dewy grass.
Better keep your heart to yourself, Dustfinger.
He picked up a leaf that glowed red as fire on the dark moss. There hadn't been any leaves like that in the other world, had there? So what was the matter with him? Angry with himself, he straightened up again.
Listen, Dustfinger, you're back, he told himself firmly. Back! Forget the boy. Yes, you lost him. But you have your own world back instead. A whole world.
You're back. Can you finally believe it?
If only it wasn't so difficult. It was far easier to believe in unhappiness than in happiness. He would have to touch every flower, feel every tree, crumble the earth in his fingers, and feel the first gnat bite on his skin before he really believed it. But yes, he was back. He really was back, at last. And suddenly happiness went to his head like a glass of strong wine. Even the thought of Farid couldn't cloud it anymore. His 10-year nightmare was over. How light he felt, light as one of the leaves raining down from the trees like gold. He was happy.
Remember, Dustfinger, this is what it feels like. Happiness.
Sure enough, Orpheus had read him into the very place he described. There was the pool, shimmering among gray-white stones, surrounded by flowering oleander, and only a little way from the bank stood the plane tree where the fire elves nested. Their nests seemed to cluster more densely around the trunk than he remembered. A less practiced eye might have taken them for bees' nests, but they were smaller and rather paler, almost as pale as the bark peeling from the tall trunk to which they clung. Dustfinger looked around, once again breathing the air he had missed so much these last 10 years. Since he had almost forgotten, mingled with others that could be found in the other world, too. And you could find trees like the ones around the pool there, too, although smaller and much younger. Branches of eucalyptus and alder reached out over the water as if to cool their leaves. Dustfinger cautiously made his way through the trees until he reached the bank. A tortoise made off at a leisurely pace when his shadow fell on its shell. The tongue of a toad sitting on a stone shot out and swallowed a fire elf. Swarms of them were whirring about over the water, with their high-pitched buzzing that always sounded so angry. It was time to raid their nests. Dustfinger kneeled down on one of the damp stones. Something rustled behind him, and for a moment he caught himself looking for Farid's dark hair and Gwyn's head with its little horns, but it was only a lizard pushing its way out of the leaves and crawling up to one of the stones to bask in the autumn sunlight.
Idiot, he muttered, leaning forward. Forget the boy. And as for the mountain, he won't miss you. Anyway, you had good reasons for leaving him behind. The best of reasons.
His reflection trembled on the dark water.
His face was the same as ever. Well, the scars are still there, of course. But at least he'd suffer no further injuries. His nose hadn't been smashed in. He didn't have a stiff leg like Cockerel in the other story. Everything was in the right place.
He even still had his voice, so the man Orpheus obviously knew his trade. Dustfinger bent lower over the water.
Where were they?
Had they forgotten him? The blue fairies forget every face, often just minutes after seeing it. But what about these others? 10 years is a long time, but did they count years? The water moved, and his reflection mingled with other features. Toad-like eyes were looking up at him from an almost human face, with long hair drifting in the water like grass and equally green and fine. Dustfinger took his hand out of the cool water, and another hand stretched up. A slender, delicate hand, almost like a child's, covered with scales so tiny that you could scarcely see them. A damp finger, cool as the water from which it had risen, touched his face and traced the scars on it. "Yes, it's not easy to forget my face, is it?" Dustfinger spoke so quietly that his voice was scarcely more than a whisper. Loud voices frighten water nymphs. "So, you remember the scars? And do you remember what I asked you and your sisters to do for me when I was here before?" The toad-like eyes looked at him, black and gold, and then the water nymph sank and vanished as if she had been a mere illusion. But a few moments later, three of them appeared together in the dark water. Shoulders white as lily petals shimmered beneath the surface, fishtails with rainbow scales like the belly of a perch flicked, barely visible in the water below. The tiny gnats dancing above the water stung Dustfinger's face and arms, as if they had been waiting just for him, but he hardly felt it. The nymphs hadn't forgotten him. Neither his face, nor what he needed from them to help him summon fire. They reached their hands up out of the water. Tiny air bubbles rose to the surface, the sign of their laughter, as silent as everything else about them. They took his hands between their own, stroked his arms, his face, his bare throat, until his skin was almost as cool as theirs and covered with the same fine, slimy deposit that protected their scales. Then, as suddenly as they had come, they disappeared again. The faces sank down into the dark pool, and Dustfinger might have thought, as always, that he had only dreamed them, but for the cool sensation on his skin, the shimmering of his hands and arms. "Thank you," he whispered, although only his reflection now quivered on the water. And he straightened up and made his way through the oleander bushes on the bank and moved toward the fire tree as silently as possible. If Farid had been here, he'd have been prancing through the wet grass like a foal in his excitement. Cobwebs, wet with dew, clung to Dustfinger's clothes as he stood under the plane tree. The lowest nests hung so far down that he could easily reach into one of the entrance holes. The first elves came swarming angrily out when he put in the fingers that the water nymphs had covered with moist slime, but he calmed them by humming quietly. If he could hit the right note, their agitated swirling soon turned to a tumbling flight, their own humming and buzzing becoming drowsy until their tiny hot bodies settled on his arms, burning his skin and leaving a tiny deposit of soot. However much it hurt, he must not flinch, mustn't scare them away, must reach even further into the nests until he found what he was looking for. Their fiery honey. Bees stung, but fire elves burned holes in your skin if the water nymphs hadn't touched it first. And even with their protection, it was prudent not to be too greedy when you stole the elves' honey. If a robber took too much, they would fly in his face, burn his skin and hair, and they wouldn't let him go until he was writhing in pain at the foot of their tree. But Dustfinger was never greedy enough to annoy them. He only took a tiny piece of honeycomb from the nest, scarcely larger than his thumbnail. That was all he needed for now. He went on humming quietly as he wrapped the honey in some leaves. The fire elves woke as soon as he stopped humming. They whirred around him faster and faster while their voices rose to sound like bumblebees buzzing angrily. However, they did not attack him. You had to ignore them, act as if you hadn't even seen them as you turned and walked away at your leisure, slowly, very slowly. They went on whirling in the air around Dustfinger for some time, but in the end they fell behind him, and he followed the small stream that flowed out of the water nymph's pool and wound slowly away through the willows, reeds, and alders. He knew where the stream would take him, out of the wayless wood, where you hardly ever met another soul of your own kind, and then on northward to places where the forest belonged to human beings, and its timber fell to their axes so fast that most trees died before the canopies could offer shelter to so much as a single horseman. The stream would lead him through the valley as it slowly opened out, past hills where no man had ever set foot because they were full of giants and bears and creatures that had never been given a name. At some point, the first charcoal burners' huts would appear on the slopes. Dustfinger would see the first patch of bare earth among the dense green. And then he would be reunited not just with fairies and water nymphs, but, he hoped, with some of those human beings he had missed for so long. He moved into cover when a sleepy wolf appeared between two trees in the distance and waited, motionless, until its gray muzzle had disappeared. Yes, bears and wolves. He must learn to listen for their steps again, to sense their presence nearby before they saw him. Not forgetting the big wildcats, dappled like tree trunks in the sunlight, and the snakes as green as the foliage where they like to hide. They would let themselves down from the branches with less sound than his hand would make brushing a leaf off his shoulder. Luckily, the giants generally stayed in their hills, where not even he dared go. Only in winter did they sometimes come down. But there were other creatures, too, beings less gentle than the water nymphs. And they couldn't be lulled by humming like the fire elves could. They were usually invisible, well hidden among timber and green leaves, but they were no less dangerous for that. Tree men, trolls, black bogles, nightmares. Some of them even ventured as far as the charcoal burners' huts.
Take a little more care, Dustfinger whispered to himself. You don't want your first day home to be your last.
The sheer intoxication of being back gradually died down, allowing him to think more clearly again, but the happiness remained in his heart, soft and warm like a young bird's downy plumage. He took off his clothes beside a stream and washed the water nymph's slimy deposit off his body, together with the fire elves soot in the grime of the other world. Then he put on the clothes that he hadn't worn for 10 years. He looked after them carefully. But there were a few moth holes in the black fabric all the same, and the sleeves had already been threadbare when he first took them off in that other world. These garments were all red and black, the colors worn by fire eaters, just as tightrope walkers clothed themselves in the blue of the sky. He stroked the rough material, put on the full-sleeved doublet, and threw the dark cloak over his shoulders. Luckily, everything still fitted. Getting new clothes made was an expensive business, even if you just took your old clothes to the tailor to be patched up again, as the strolling players usually did. When twilight fell, he looked around for a safe place to sleep. Finally, he climbed up onto a fallen oak with its root ball towering so high into the air that it offered good shelter for the night. The root ball was like a great rampart of earth, yet some of the roots still clung to the ground as if unwilling to let go of life. The crown of the fallen tree had put out new shoots, although they now pointed to the ground, and not to the sky. Dustfinger nimbly clambered along the mighty trunk, digging his fingers into its rough bark. When he reached the roots, which were now thrusting up into the air as if they could find nourishment there, a few fairies flew up, chattering, crossing. They had obviously been looking for building materials for their nests. Of course, it would soon be autumn. Time for a more weatherproof sleeping place. The blue fairies took no particular trouble over the nests they built in the spring, but as soon as the first leaf turned color, they began improving them, padding them with animal fur and bird's feathers, weaving more grass and twigs into the walls, sealing cracks with moss and fairy spit. Two of the tiny blue creatures didn't fly away when they saw him. They stared avidly at his sandy hair as the evening light falling through the treetops tinged their wings with red.
Oh, of course, Dustfinger laughed softly. You want some of my hair for your nests?
He cut off a lock with his knife. One of the delighted fairies seized the hair in her delicate insect-like hands and fluttered quickly away with it. The other fairy, so tiny that she could only have just hatched from her mother-of-pearl egg, followed her. He had missed those bold little blue creatures. He'd missed them so much. Down below among the trees, night was falling, but in the light of the setting sun, the treetops overhead were turning red as sorrel in a summer meadow. Soon the fairies would be asleep in their nests, the mice and rabbits in their holes and burrows. The cool of the night would make the lizard's legs stiff, the birds would fall silent,
predators would prepare to go hunting, their eyes like yellow lights in the darkness.
Let's hope they don't fancy a fire here for dinner, thought Dustfinger, stretching his legs out on the fallen trunk.
He thrust his knife into the cracked bark beside him, wrapped himself in the cloak he hadn't worn for 10 years, and stared up at the leaves. They were growing darker and darker now. An owl rose from an oak and swooped away, little more than a shadow among the branches. A tree whispered in its sleep, words that no human ear could understand. Dustfinger closed his eyes and listened. He was home again.
Chapter 4 Silvertongue's Daughter. Meggie hated quarreling with Mo. It left her shaking inside, and nothing could comfort her. Not a hug from her mother, not the licorice candies Reese's Aunt Eleanor gave her if their loud voices had carried into the library, not Darius, who firmly believed in the miraculous healing powers of hot milk and honey in such cases. Nothing helped. This time, it had been particularly bad, because Mo had really only come to see her to say goodbye. He had a new job waiting, some sick books too old and valuable to be sent to him. In the past, Meggie would have gone with him, but this time she had decided to stay with Eleanor and her mother. Why did he have to come to her room just when she was reading the notebooks again? They'd often quarreled over those notebooks recently, although Mo hated a quarrel as much as she did. Afterward, he usually disappeared into the workshop that Eleanor had built behind the house for him, and a time would come, once Meggie couldn't bear to be angry with him anymore, when she would follow him there. He never raised his head when she slipped in through the doorway, and without a word, Meggie would sit down beside him on the chair that was always ready for her and watch him work, just as she had done even before she could read. She loved watching his hands free a book from its shabby dress, separate stained pages from each other, part the threads holding together a damaged quire, or soak rag paper to mend a sheet of paper worn thin. It was never long before Mo turned and asked her a question of some kind. Did she like the color he'd chosen for a linen binding? Did she agree that the paper pulp he'd mixed for repairs had turned out slightly too dark? It was Mo's way of apologizing, of saying, "Don't let's quarrel, Meggie. Let's just forget what we said just now." But that was no good today. Because he hadn't disappeared into his workshop, he'd gone away to see some book collector or other and give the collector's printed treasures a new lease on life. This time, he wouldn't come to her with the present to make up the quarrel. A book he'd found in a second-hand bookshop somewhere, or a book decorated with blue jay feathers found in Eleanor's garden. So why couldn't she have been reading some other book when he came into her room?
Good heavens, Meggie.
You seem to have nothing in your head but those notebooks, he had said angrily. It had been the same every time these last few months, whenever he found her like that in her room, lying on the rug, deaf and blind to all that went on around her, eyes glued to the words with which she had written down what Reese had told her, tales of what she had seen there, as Mo bitterly called it. There. Inkworld was the name Meggie gave to the place of which Mo spoke so slightingly, and her mother sometimes with such longing. Inkworld. After the book about it, Ink Heart. The book was gone, but her mother's memories were as vivid as if not a day had passed since she was there, and that world of paper and printer's ink, where there were fairies and princes, water nymphs, fire elves, and trees that seemed to grow to the sky. Meggie had sat with her mother for countless days and nights, writing down what Reese's fingers told her. Risa had left her voice behind in the ink world, so she talked to her daughter either with pencil and paper or with her hands, telling the stories of those years, those terrible magical years, she called them. Sometimes she also drew what her eyes had seen but her tongue could no longer describe, fairies, birds, strange flowers, conjured up on paper with just a few strokes, yet looking so real that Meggie almost believed she had seen them too. At first, Mo himself had bound the notebooks in which Meggie wrote down Reese's memories, and each binding was more beautiful than the last, but a time came when Meggie noticed the anxiety in his eyes as he watched her reading them, completely absorbed in the words and pictures. Of course she understood his uneasiness. After all, for years he had lost his wife to this world made of words and paper. How could he like it if his daughter thought of little else? Oh, yes. Maggie understood Mo very well. Yet she couldn't do as he asked. Close the books and forget the Inkworld for a while. Perhaps her longing for it wouldn't have been quite as strong if the fairies and brownies had still been around. All those strange creatures they had brought back from Capricorn's accursed village. But none of them lived in Eleanor's garden now. The fairies' empty nests still clung to the trees, and the burrows that the brownies had dug were still there, but their inhabitants were gone. At first, Eleanor thought that they had run away or been stolen. But then the ashes had been found. They covered the grass in the garden, fine as dust, gray ashes, as gray as the shadows from which Eleanor's strange guests had once appeared. And Maggie had realized that there was no return from death, even for creatures made of nothing but words. Eleanor, however, could not reconcile herself to this idea. Defiantly, desperately, she had driven back to Capricorn's village, only to find the streets empty, the houses burned down, and not a living soul in sight. "You know, Eleanor," Mo had said when she came back with her face tear-stained, "I was afraid of something like this. I couldn't really believe there were words to bring back the dead. And besides, if you're honest with yourself, you must admit that they didn't fit into this world."
"Nor do I,"
was all Eleanor had replied. Over the next few weeks, Maggie often heard sobbing from Eleanor's room when she slipped into the library one last time in the evening to find a book. Many months had passed since then. They had all been living together in Eleanor's big house for nearly a year, and Maggie had a feeling that Eleanor was glad not to be alone with her books anymore. She had given them the best rooms. Eleanor's old schoolbooks and a few writers she no longer much liked had been banished to the attic to make more space. Maggie's room had a view of snow-topped mountains, and from her parents' bedroom you could see the distant lake with its gleaming water, which had so often tempted the fairies to fly in that direction. Mo had never simply gone off like that before. Without a word of goodbye? Without making up the quarrel?
Well, perhaps I should go down and help Darius in the library, thought Maggie as she sat down wiping tears from her face.
She never cried while she was quarreling with Mo. Tears didn't come until later, and he always looked terribly guilty when he saw her red eyes. She was sure that yet again everyone had heard them quarreling. Darius was probably making the hot milk and honey already. And as soon as she put her head around the kitchen door, Eleanor would begin calling Mo and men in general names. No, she better stay in her own room.
Oh, Mo.
He had snatched the notebook she was reading out of her hand and taken it with him. And that one was the book where she had collected ideas for stories of her own. Beginnings that had never gotten any further, opening words, crossed out sentences, all her failed attempts. How could he just take it away from her? She didn't want Mo to read it. She didn't want him seeing how she tried in vain to fit the words together on paper, words that came to her tongue so easily and with such power when she read aloud. Maggie could write down what Risa described to her. She could fill pages and pages with the stories her mother told her. But as soon as she tried to make something new of them, a story with a life of its own, her mind went blank. The words seemed to fly out of her head, like snowflakes, leaving only a damp patch on your skin where you put your hand to catch them. Someone knocked on Maggie's door.
"Come in,"
she snuffled, looking in her trouser pockets for one of the old-fashioned handkerchiefs that Eleanor had given her.
"They belong to my sister. Her name began with an M, like yours. Embroidered in the corner. There. See? I thought it would be better for you to have them than to let the moths eat holes in them."
Her mother put her head around the door. Maggie tried to smile, but it was a miserable failure. "Can I come in?" Risa's fingers traced the words in the air faster than Darius could have said them aloud. Maggie nodded. By now she understood her mother's sign language almost as easily as the letters of the alphabet. She knew it better than Mo, and much better than Eleanor, who often called for Maggie in desperation when Risa's fingers went too fast for her. Risa closed the door behind her and sat down on the windowsill with her daughter. Maggie always called her mother by her first name, perhaps because she hadn't had a mother for 10 years, or perhaps because, for the same inexplicable reason that she had always called her father just Mo. Maggie recognized the notebook as soon as Risa put it on her lap. It was the one that Mo had taken. "I found it lying outside your door," said her mother's hands. Maggie stroked the patterned binding. So, Mo had brought it back. Why hadn't he come in? Because he was still too angry? Or because he was sorry? "He wants me to put them away in the attic. At least for a while." Maggie suddenly felt so small. At the same time, so old.
"He said, perhaps I ought to turn into a glass man or dye my skin blue, since my wife and daughter obviously think more of fairies and glass men than of me."
Risa smiled and stroked Maggie's nose with her forefinger.
"Yes, I know, of course, he doesn't really think that. But he always gets so angry when he sees me with the notebooks."
Risa looked out through the open window. Eleanor's garden was so large that you couldn't see where it began or ended. You just saw tall trees and rhododendron shrubs so old that they surrounded Eleanor's house like an evergreen wood. Right under Maggie's window was a lawn with a narrow gravel path around it. A garden seat stood to one side of the lawn. Maggie still remembered the night when she had sat there watching Dustfinger breathe fire. Eleanor's ever-grumpy gardener had swept the dead leaves off the lawn only that afternoon. You could still see the bare patch in the middle where Capricorn's men had burned Eleanor's best books. The gardener kept trying to persuade Eleanor to plant something in that space, or sow more grass seeds there, but Eleanor just shook her head energetically.
"No, pah! Who grows grass on a grave?"
She had snapped the last time he suggested it, and she told him to leave the yarrow alone, too. It had grown luxuriantly around the sides of the blackened patch ever since the fire, as if to make its flat flower heads a reminder of the night when Eleanor's printed children were swallowed up by the flames. The sun was setting behind the nearby mountains, so red it was as if it, too, wanted to remind them of that long-extinguished fire, and a cool wind blew from the hills, making Risa shiver. Maggie closed the window. The wind blew a few faded rose petals against the pane. They stuck to the glass, pale yellow and translucent.
"I don't want to quarrel with him," she whispered. "I never used to quarrel with Mo. Well, almost never. Perhaps he's right."
Her mother pushed back her hair. It was just as long as Maggie's, but darker, as if a shadow had fallen on it. Risa usually held it back with barrettes. Maggie often wore her hair like that, too, and sometimes when she looked at her reflection in the mirror of her wardrobe, she seemed to be seeing not herself, but a younger version of her mother.
"Another year, and she will be towering over you," Mo sometimes said when he wanted to tease Risa.
And the short-sighted Darius had confused Maggie with her mother several times already. Risa ran her forefinger over the window pane as if tracing the rose petals that clung to it. Then her hands began speaking again, hesitantly, just as lips can sometimes hesitate. "I do understand your father, Maggie," she said. "Sometimes I myself think the two of us talk about that other world too often. Even I don't understand why I keep coming back to the subject. And I'm always telling you about what was beautiful there, not the other things. Being shut up. Mortola's punishments. How my hands and knees hurt so much from all the work that I couldn't sleep. All the cruelty that I saw there. Did I tell you about the maid who died of fright because a nightmare stole into our bedroom?"
"Yes, you did."
Maggie moved very close to her mother, but Risa's hands fell silent. They were still roughened from all her years of toil as a maid, working first for Mortola and then for Capricorn.
"You've told me about everything," said Maggie.
"The bad things, too, even if Mo won't believe it.
Because all the same, he feels that we dream only of the wonderful parts, as if I ever had much of those."
Risa shook her head. Again her fingers fell silent for a long time before she let them go on.
"I had to steal it for myself, in seconds, minutes. Sometimes a precious hour when we were allowed out in the forest to gather the plants Mortola needed for her black potions.
But
There were the years when you were free, too, when you disguised yourself and worked in the markets as a scribe. Disguised as a man. Meggie had pictured it over and over again, her mother with her hair cut short, wearing a scribe's tunic, ink on her fingers from the finest handwriting to be found in